Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
You know, people tell me they want to jump on the internet. I say, why? What did it ever do to you? Hello and welcome to the show, hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting and sponsored this week by Tenable Network Security, makers of fine security information management consoles and vulnerability scanning swag. I'm back from my most recent European adventure, and while I couldn't find any rocks to climb, I stuffed my face with French and Italian food. The Risky Business Podcast, now with back fat. We've got a lot of stuff to catch up on this week, so shortly we'll be bringing Mania Katadia from ZDNet Australia onto the show to bring us up to speed. This week's feature interview is with Morgan Marquis-Bois. He's a SCADA pen tester and he's due to give a talk at DEF CON in Vegas this year on that topic. So we'll have a bit of a chat to him. And this week's sponsor interview is a lot of fun as well. We've got Marcus J. Ranham coming on the show to discuss deperimeterization. He's one of our favourite industry cynics and he joins us soon. He is, of course, the Chief Security Officer of Tenable Network Security in the States. But right now it's time to get started with the news by bringing on Mania. And Moon, we've got a lot to cover off this week. It's been pretty hectic since last time we spoke.
Yeah, last time we spoke was, what, 1987 or something, wasn't it?
Feels like it, yeah. I've been busy working on my love handles in Europe. It's been great.
That's right. Enjoying the summer out there, huh?
Yeah, and enjoying the food, the foie gras. So, look, we've got a lot to get through, so we better get cracking. In this first story that I've picked out, and I should just warn the listeners, because it's been a couple of weeks since we've done the news, we're going to go over stuff that's a couple of weeks old. The UK Defence Department has lost secret information on USB keys.
According to this report here, they've lost 87 data storage devices since 2004. That's about one a month, right?
Yeah. Now, what I find fascinating about this piece is that you've got devices, five of them actually had data on them that were classified as secret. So I'd like to know which Brightspark decided to, like, throw secret classified documents onto a USB stick to, what, take home for the weekend or something?
One thing I'm really interested about is that none of these reports have said anything about encryption.
No, no. And, I mean, I think these days it's well understood that you need to encrypt anything that's going outside, but how it got onto those, how their security policies allowed things to go onto those devices in the first place is, you know, it's you've got to transfer material some way, don't you?
You do, but not if it's not encrypted. That's just daft. That's, you know, schoolboy errors. In fact, schoolboys wouldn't make those errors these days.
No, Generation Y probably a lot better at locking down their stuff, aren't they? The fact is, the report didn't mention anything about encryption. I suppose if solid encryption was used on those devices, it's not really a big deal. But then again, if it was used on those devices, coming clean wouldn't be a big deal and we wouldn't be talking about it, right?
So, yeah, I reckon.
So chances are that was just clear text secret data. Well, yeah. Good on you, UK government.
Yeah, well done.
Now, next up, we got some very controversial comments made by Linus Torvalds, of course, the creator of the Linux operating system. Do you care to walk us through this one, Mania?
Okay, so basically Torvalds is saying OpenBSD. He called them a bunch of masturbating monkeys, basically, because they're so obsessed with fixing security bugs, and he says they don't really worry about any of the other ones.
This is one of those European gags that just, I guess, doesn't translate, because I don't get it. I just don't even think it's funny.
About the masturbating monkey.
Masturbating monkey, that's the best insult you can come up with, Linus. Come on, man. You've revolutionized computing, and you're going to call people masturbating monkeys? I mean, call them asshats, call them douchetards. But
hey, he did change it a little bit because afterwards he called all dig users a bunch of wanking walruses.
Wanking walruses. Well, at least that rhymes. Oh, well, I suppose masturbating monkeys, it's an alliteration, but it's not exactly a clever one. Anyway, that's
But you're not
bit
impressed with these comments, are you?
Look, I'm not, you know, because I think he's really had a go. I understand where he's coming from. What he's basically said is that when security researchers find a bug, they sort of roll out the entire marketing apparatus behind them and turn it into this huge circus where they overhype the bug, you know, and we see it all the time. So I think some of his criticisms were really quite valid. But then he starts talking about, I don't think some spectacular security hole should be glorified or cared about as being any more special than a random spectacular crash due to bad locking. And I think that's where, for me, that's where he's gone off base. That's where he's starting to sound a little bit silly.
Well, you know what? OpenBSD developers agree with you, surprise, surprise.
Yeah, well, I'm not so surprised by that. But
we've got Bob Beck here in another story, an OpenBSD developer, and he goes, Torvalds' comments show ignorance. as BSD coders did take the approach of dealing with bugs equally. And he says the comments sound much like the usual chest beating, and we're just seeing to make all the fanboys and girls in the list swoon.
Yeah, well, look, I think to an extent that's true, and I also think that security bugs, not surprisingly, being, you know, kind of a security dude, I think security bugs are more important. If you've got some sort of remote zero day in your code, you know, you might want to fix that before the little graphics glitch that, you know, occasionally causes your screen to blink once every 10 days, you know? It's more serious.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got here again, even Linus, he didn't continue. He was just being ridiculous and silly here. What's this? OpenBSD developer Grabowski. He just said he talked to Linus about it already. He was humbled and said we didn't look like it from the outside, but we shared the same view.
Yeah, yeah. Look, I mean, and it's hard to write off a guy like Linus Torvalds, who's done a lot for computing.
Yeah.
But, you know, at the same time, I think he went a little bit overboard with some of his comments.
I don't know. I agree with his dig ones, though. Wanking walruses.
I'm just trying to think what you'd call Slashdot users. If dig users are wanking walruses, these guys would be like tossing tigers.
Tossing. Yeah, tossing.
Tossing tigers. That's it. Slashdot users are tossing tigers. Okay. Welcome back, Manir. It's good. This is good. Risky Business was a bit too serious without you.
Oh, dear.
Now, look, this next story, anyone out there running a BlackBerry Enterprise server, you guys definitely want to disable the ability for the PDF component, which takes PDF files and translates them into a format that can be read by BlackBerries, because there is a high-severity flaw in BlackBerry Enterprise server at the moment.
This is really interesting stuff. According to RIM, if a BlackBerry smartphone user opens a specially crafted PDF attachment, then it allows arbitrary code to be executed on the actual computer. And because it's got such a high privilege level, you can go and mess with other machines on the same network.
Yeah, now this is a really great bug, you know, because what it means is that if I'm a BlackBerry user, and I want to, you know, download a PDF and view it, it actually goes through some sort of conversion process on the BlackBerry Enterprise server, which means that just through exploiting the conversion process, you are exploiting a bug on the Enterprise server itself. So really, if you start spamming PDFs to all of the BlackBerry users at a particular organization, and one of them just happens to open it, you've pwned the Enterprise server itself. And that's obviously pretty bad.
This was, the story did come out on the 16th of July, and I understand that it may have been fixed by now. They may have put an update out there, but if you haven't updated your systems, then yeah, this is pretty damn serious.
Look, this next piece has been doing the rounds for a little while. Everyone's going a little bit circumspect about what is actually going to be demonstrated.
But are you talking about Intel now?
Yeah, there's an independent security researcher, Chris Kaspersky, who's no relation to Kaspersky Antivirus or Eugene Kaspersky. He's flagged plans to reveal a proof-of-concept security exploit that could work remotely against any machine using Intel processors. So he's targeting security bugs in chipsets.
Yeah, that's right. Apparently he's going to, this is a presentation he's preparing for Hack in the Box in Malaysia coming up in October. And he says that, you know, Intel Core 2 Duo has 128 known bugs and Intanium has over 230. And although Intel has given BIOS vendors workarounds to close some of the bugs, some of them still remain open and exploitable.
Yeah, and he says he's figured out a way to exploit these using TCP/IP packets, right? So just by hitting the NIC with packets. So we've really got to wait and see what he demos. I mean, it could be a bit of a fizzer, but it also has potential to be quite frightening as well, because, you know, if you're finding something that's targeting a system at such a low level, and this is something that we've taken up on the show over the last few shows, really looking at that hardware security issue, you got a world of pain coming at you, because the fact is your operating system can't do much about it, and anything loaded on top of the operating system can't do much about it. So let's hope this guy is smoking crack and he's actually not that good, because if he is, we're in a world of pain.
And of course, this could be a great big thrill for Mac users as well. Now we're all Intel, so it affects everything.
Oh yeah, like OS X secure it all anyway, man. Like, that's just such... Anyway, moving on.
Let's not go there. Let's wait until the next proper story comes up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So this is a story that's been doing the rounds. Again, it's a little bit old now, but San Francisco network admin, he's locked other administrators out of the network. It's the city of San Francisco's network. Now, this is the guy. He's a CCIE, and he maintained all of the routing equipment, basically all of their Cisco kit. And he said, nah, not giving you the password, and now he's in prison.
I find this really humorous. Apparently, the network is up and running, despite the fact that administrators have limited to no access to the systems. But even from prison, it's all still working. Okay, and apparently, this guy, they did him for poor performance. He got really upset and allegedly locked everyone out.
Well, I don't think anyone was allowed in the first place. PC World has a really good write-up on this. If you do a Google News search for Terry Childs, which is the guy's name, you'll find it. And apparently he's a really good admin but he was like one of those guys who gets a little bit obsessive over about who he lets access the network. And really he is that good that he wouldn't let other people access the network for years and years and years because he was worried that they were going to stuff something up. So it's a very interesting case here. And no one really, I mean, I don't think it's quite as sinister as has been reported. We don't know what's going on here, but the fact is he's in prison. They've set $5 million bail, which is pretty serious. So they don't want to let the guy out. And, you know, I guess he's just holding on to passwords for now.
Yeah, and he's not letting them go. And so the only guy who can access them is in prison.
Yeah, so I guess
quite
really,
a strange situation to be in.
It is. And I think the way he's set up the network too, it's, you know, it's going to be really hard for them to regain control of the network. So I guess it's a bit of a lesson out there that if you've got one guy just controlling everything, things can go a bit skew-whiff. But, you know, typically that can actually be the price of getting the best guy in the field, is they get obsessed with controlling everything. Now, this is a clever attack that's surfaced recently, which is there was a bit of a study released into the package handlers of BSD and Linux and whatnot, and they found that what you could actually do is trick a packet, an update installer, like, you know, Red Hat Package Management or whatever, to install old updates, which came with vulnerabilities. So you could get it to install an old version of Apache. And of course, the crypto signing on that package would be valid. And then once you've tricked that box into installing a vulnerable package, you can pwn it through an old vulnerability.
It's so smart. It's great. I mean, you know, you hit the thing that does the update, you make it not update or even go backwards, and then you've got it creating vulnerabilities. It's such a clever move.
It is. It's reversing the updating process and getting people to install backwards code, like stuff that's full of bugs.
Yeah, it's really funny. And the fact is, it's so widespread here. You guys, the researchers that did a report said they examined 10 popular package managers for Linux and BSD systems and found vulnerabilities in all of them.
Yeah, they're all totally pwnable. So, I mean, if you... It just makes you really think, because a lot of people do use these package managers to maintain their systems. And, you know, if they've got them... You know, a skilled attacker could definitely take advantage of this, that's for sure.
Yeah, and it's all of them. It's just quite scary.
Yeah. Now, this is a great little exclusive that you guys got. It was courtesy of Liam Tung, your reporter.
Yep.
And he happened to be at a conference where the General Manager of Security and Emergency Management for Woodside Petroleum had a bit of a go at the government. Of course, they're a member of TISN, which is the Trusted Information Sharing Network, and this bloke reckons it leaks. It leaks like a sieve.
Well, that's right. I mean, the actual guy from Bill Forbes, who's the General Manager of Security and Emergency Management for Woodside Petroleum, and he's also the co-chair, the TISN's energy group, said the government agencies have failed to keep their side of the bargain by, you know, they're spreading out and leaking corporate secrets.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is a case of loose lips sinking ships. But, you know, I'm as much as I have no reason to doubt this guy's credibility, the fact that things are leaking, I mean, I don't know how he would actually know that it was TISN. He might have some sort of other problem.
You're totally right there. I mean, yeah, this was Liam in the conference, and this is what he actually said. Forbes said, "It's a great concern when I've got executives from my company looking at me saying they've just heard from a counterpart in another company something that we've communicated to TISN in good faith." And basically, he said it's been passed into competitors within his sector. But you're absolutely right. There's no evidence to suggest that it came from them. It could have come a leak another way.
But either way, I mean, it's going to make other members of TISN a little bit, you know, circumspect about sharing sensitive data. And that's the whole point of having a trusted information sharing network for you know, companies like Woodside who have critical infrastructure, is so that they can trust the government to facilitate the movement of information. So, yeah,
obviously, the government completely denied it and said, no, there's no way it would have come from us.
Yeah, well, that doesn't tell us much, does it?
No.
You know, so there's no real way for us to know the real story, unfortunately. But, you know, that's the way it goes. This next piece is kind of interesting. A Microsoft patch has, the technical term is balked. A Microsoft patch has balked Zone Alarm.
Yeah, that's right. Basically, if you had Zone Alarm set up on your system for auto updates and you had it set on high, as soon as you got this most recent Microsoft Patch Tuesday thing, suddenly you were cut off.
Yeah, and you couldn't connect to the internet. Now, no. I'm not sure, that was about 10 days ago, so they may have fixed that by now, but still, it's unfortunate when these sorts of things happen.
Definitely is, and just happens to be Zone Alarm as well, which is quite interesting.
Yeah, so it means that, yeah, if you've downloaded this patch, you can no longer connect to the internet, which makes fixing it a little bit difficult, you've got to admit. And, Moon, of course, the other big story that we missed while I was away was this massive coordinated DNS patch. It's kind of old news now. I think everyone's moved on. It was a problem to do with the randomness of the source port or something like that. Or no, randomness of the transaction ID values. So it was a poisoning bug. It's been around for a while, but this was a much more serious sort of variant of it. It's been fixed. That's it. Enough said, right?
Enough said. Okay.
Okay, well, Moon, thank you very much for joining us to do the news again this week.
Hey, you're very welcome.
ZDNet Australia's editor, Mania Katadia, there with this week's news headlines. Now it's time to check in with Morgan Marquis-Bois. He works for what used to be securityassessment.com in New Zealand, which is now a division of Datacraft, and his specialty is SCADA. We all know about SCADA and we all know it's a problem, but Morgan actually spends enough time on this stuff to tell us quite a few things we did not know before. And I also thought it would be worthwhile getting Morgan's perspective on the hype surrounding China's alleged infiltration of Western utilities' SCADA networks.
There's a lot of overhype around the China thing, actually, that I think's already been addressed on your podcast. I mean, I seem to recall, you know, a few podcasts ago, someone saying, well, just because we're seeing attacks out of China means that, you know, the idea that they are originating from China is actually pretty shaky, right? Like, there's just so many vulnerable boxes in China. But, I mean, there's been a couple of really high-profile articles recently surrounding Chinese hackers eating your baby, drinking your beer, and crashing your power grid, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, we've got, like, CIA senior analyst Tom Donahue in January this year said stuff like, we have information from multiple regions outside the United States of cyber intrusion into utilities followed by extortion demands.
Mm.
You know, and it's sort of like, oh, okay, that's suitably vague, but it's coming from the CIA, so, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But then, like, recently we had this big-ass article in the National Journal magazine where it said computer hackers in China, including those working behalf of the government, penetrated deeply into U.S. companies, government agencies, blah, 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 possibly triggering two recent widespread blackouts in Florida, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, it's funny, actually, Morgan, that you bring up that story, because there was some interesting stuff in that story which involved lots of cloak and dagger stuff with, like, a laptop being left behind in a hotel room and then imaged and then data being used on, you know, it just seemed pretty interesting.
Well, my favorite quote in that story says, there has never been official U.S. government assertion of Chinese involvement in the outage, but intelligence and other government officials did not explicitly rule out a Chinese role. You know, senior officials believe that China played a role in the blackout that is not still fully understood.
Well, that clearly means they did it. It was the Chinese.
Clearly.
And I think we should...
Well, there's a really good article, actually, by Paulson. I mean, I think Schneier's quote's the best, which just says, this is all so much nonsense, I don't even know where to begin.
Yeah.
Using the most devious malware ever devised, Chinese arranged for trees to grow up into the power lines.
You reckon they're going to hack the DNA of the trees?
I think there's nothing that Chinese hackers can't do, you know?
Well, apparently not. But look, as I was saying, the whole SCADA thing is a bit blah, 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 and it's all about China, you know, turning your potatoes fluorescent and all of that
crap, sure.
Right?
But, I mean, there's that scary video that the U.S. government released sort of September last year, you know, showing the smoking power generators of the CNN. Like, whip up some more fear.
Oh, well, that's always fun. But hang on. Let me finish, right? So we've seen all of the fear-mongering around the China thing. But recently, we have actually seen some pretty scary vulnerabilities in some SCADA kit. Can you walk us through those? I believe they were, like, something as simple as a buffer overflow that would actually take down a whole bunch of shiz.
So it's actually quite... There's some hilarity around these ones, actually, as well. So there's been a couple of good stuff coming out from the core guys, right? And
it was them too, wasn't it? Those guys keep coming up with the goods. Kudos, core guys, if you're listening.
Machines.
Yeah.
But there was there's kind of two that both popped out, I think, this month, actually. We're still in June, yeah. So there was one in Wonderware. Wonderware is like a massive SCADA provider, right? Like, when I've been doing SCADA pen testing and that sort of thing, I've encountered Wonderware in a variety of situations. And we'll see that they're actually kind of an interesting provider to deal with. So there was a Sweetlink denial of service vulnerability, which was basically a result of a lack of error checking and program memory allocation. So you sent a malformed packet to an IP port, service terminates, right?
Yeah.
You know, 90s called, they want their vulns back.
Yeah.
Now, what gets really hilarious is if you read down the core advisory, they talk about dealing with Wonderware. And one of the bits says, oh, you know, core sends proof of concept code written in Python on, you know, 3rd of March. 5th of March, vendor asks for compiler tools required to use the proof of concept code.
Oh.
Core sends back link to python.org where Python interpreter can be downloaded.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's actually in the core documentation, is it?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of like, what's interesting here is, one, it's kind of an example of what you get when you're dealing with SCADA vendors, and, like, two, the sort of example of the vulns you're finding. Like, the other one they released was, like, your really canonical kind of Stack Overflow, right, where you've got a server listening on a port waiting to receive an initial packet of 4 bytes due to lack of proper length checking, destination buffer, fixed size, Stack Overflow, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Whoa, that's pretty old school.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, you won't find many bits of SCADA kit that have actually got all of the fancy, you know, DEP crap in them and, you know, address space.
No
layout.
ASLR, exactly. No GS compiler flags, none of that good stuff, you know?
No, nothing like that. So it's pretty much a little playground, isn't it? But then again, some of them are using embedded, I mean, a lot of them are using embedded Windows, like Windows NT and stuff like that, aren't they?
Sure. I mean, I guess the problem you've got when it comes to all this sort of stuff is that, you know, you're talking kit that's not really built on the whole, you know, patch on patch Tuesday mentality. You've got to, you know, sort of deploy once, replace in 10 years.
Mm.
And when it comes to patching, like a lot of vendors, the SLA is that they'll release one patch a year, you know?
Mm.
And that's if you choose to apply it, which a lot of people don't, right? Because the possible risks of applying a patch and it all going horribly wrong, you know, are probably viewed as more worrying than more worrying even than the Chinese, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, what do you reckon needs to happen in order to nut out the SCADA problem? I mean, do you think network separation is the answer, or do you think just giving the SCADA vendors a clue is the answer?
So basically, network separation is always good, but air gapping is hideously expensive, right?
Mm.
Like, I've talked to SCADA, SCADA users, I mean, SCADA providers, guys that manage power and water and that sort of thing. And basically, you know, you sort of make recommendations about air gapping and they're like, yeah, that's going to cost millions of dollars, so we're not going to do it. They're like, well, fair enough. But, I mean, the problem is that traditional network security is hard here because you get like, oh, no, we've got it segregated. We've got a firewall. It's like, but your firewall is managed from the corporate side of your network, right?
Mm.
So if I own your corporate via some worm, I get onto your file server, I download your config files for all your firewalls, and then I just change them, and now I've got access to your SCADA. So, you know, that sort of stuff is hard. So I guess it's difficult for someone who looks after a water sanitation plant to be told that now their security levels have to be up to military standard and they have to start worrying about government red teams, you know?
Mm.
Because that's just not their jurisdiction. They don't have the time, the budget, or you know, the money. Beating vendors with a stick is essentially a really good idea, and I think that's fun too. What needs to happen.
It's fun too.
Oh, totally. I mean, it's a well-known hacker hobby, right? Beat the vendor.
I understand you're doing a talk at DEF CON about SCADA. What is going to be in it? Is it pretty much a variation on the thing that we saw of yours at KiwiCon last year?
It's actually quite different. The thing at KiwiCon was kind of a brief introduction to SCADA, and I kind of talked about some common issues and that sort of thing. This has a lot more sort of hands-on stuff regarding pen tests I've done, what I've seen, and I guess a bit about some intel gathering techniques that I've been developing, basically which allow you to trivially breached SCADA networks. I mean, there's a lot of stuff like, you know, radio links and so on that go on SCADA networks that I guess people don't traditionally look at when performing pen tests. So I've been sort of developing, you know, my style a bit, I guess, towards that.
You mean non-IP stuff?
Yeah, sure. So a lot of SCADA networks traditionally used to talk multi-point serial over radio link.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, this is largely due to geographically spread out nature of networks, you know, like power grids and whatnot, you know, spread over an entire country, right? A lot of these guys also don't use IP networks for monitoring. They use the pager network just because it's old and reliable. So as I said, you've got to kind of adapt because you're talking stuff that uses different technologies, different networks. I also talk a little bit in my talk about where I think we're going with all the SCADA hysteria, because I was thinking about it a bit, and I think what we're going to see is we're going to start seeing a lot more vendor activity in the SCADA world. And by vendor activity, I mean traditional IT vendors. We're going to start seeing a lot more magic bullet stuff. We've already got a firewall out called Industrial Defender. I think Checkpoint's getting into the SCADA area. You know, a bunch of other sort of well-known security vendors are already starting to think about hawking SCADA security products.
Do you think that's a positive step, that the vendors are actually jumping into the game? Would you like to be able to take a gadget from Vendor X, which is essentially a SCADA firewall? Would you recommend that those sort of devices get used?
So, it's good to beat the vendors with a stick. That was a bit glib. What I really mean is that, you know, we need open lines of communication with vendors of SCADA equipment so that they can secure their stuff. I think there's always problems with bolt-on security, obviously, and what we've really got to watch out for is the ever-present snake oil when it comes to people selling SCADA security kit. Like, I was adding a bit of sanity checking in a meeting where a vendor was trying to sell SCADA security stuff to a customer the other day, and they described the IPS as virtual patching for your SCADA network.
Mm.
Yeah, I was like, excuse me? So I think we've got to be a bit careful. Like, while it's good that people are taking the problem seriously, I think there's some dollar signs going on in some eyes of people who are pretty keen to sell stuff, whether or not it works properly, whether or not it exists. You know,
But surely, Morgan, that it would actually be possible with, because the data transmitted over a SCADA network is actually fairly simple and it's fairly structured. So
sure.
Surely you'd be able to put a some sort of sanity checker, you know, at various points on a SCADA network and look out for nefarious activity.
I guess, but the thing is, when I'm trying to own a SCADA network, right, chances are, I mean, I'm not going to be fuzzing Modbus or any low-level SCADA protocols.
Mm.
I'm going to own the Windows box that controls the DAM and hit the open button.
Yeah.
I guess looking really carefully at the value that's being added by these devices is probably what I'd advise. Like, it's a good idea. I mean, as I said, I don't want to bag on stuff before it's come out. I guess all of a sudden I was thinking about who's going to make the money out of all the SCADA hysteria, right? Like, and it's not the pen testers. It's not guys running around reviewing architecture on SCADA networks. It's people who are going to start selling magic bullet solutions, you know?
Morgan Marquis-Bois, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Pat Gray. Always a pleasure.
Morgan Marquis-Bois from Datacraft there in New Zealand. Up next, it's time to chat to Marcus Ranham from Tenable Network Security, our sponsor. Without our sponsors like Tenable, Risky Business wouldn't exist. So a big thank you to Tenable Network Security for making the show possible. Now, Marcus is a well-known guy in the InfoSec scene and these days acts as the CSO of Tenable Network Security. And this week we're speaking to Marcus about deperimeterization. It has its upsides as a concept, but it's held back by the same sorts of problems as everything else, as you'll hear.
Usually when people are talking about deperimeterization, what they're saying is something along the lines of network services are so critical that the idea of having a boundary around our network no longer makes any sense. In fact, there's so much data going back and forth that the idea of a firewall or a perimeter doesn't make sense. So what we're going to do is we're going to drop back to strong security practices on the host. We're going to make sure that the host has got everything locked down.
It's funny that you say that, Marcus, because recently we had one of the guys from Checkpoint on the show in another sponsor interview, and they were saying that, you know, they're finally actually seeing some demand for their always-on VPNs. And I'm thinking, always-on VPNs, eh? I mean, that's a really odd concept. You really are just eroding the perimeter and focusing on doing sanity checks on the endpoint, aren't you?
Right, and see, the problem is with these kinds of VPNs is that your perimeter now becomes a many-to-many web of relationships. You've still got a perimeter, but you've just got no idea where it is. It's still there. It's just incomprehensible to anybody. But so the model, the deperimeterization idea really is that the host is going to have to take care of itself. And, you know, back in the late 80s, we just called this strong host security. And being in the industry as long as I have seen organizations go from host security to perimeter security to host security to perimeter security. Neither one by itself works.
I guess what you're suggesting here is that each host actually has its own perimeter, I guess.
You see, that's the problem. The folks who are preaching deperimeterization basically say, well, each host will be an individual perimeter and everything is just fine. Well, there's two things that make that impossible. One is the problem of transitive trust, which is it's just fine if you're your own perimeter as long as you don't let anything in or out. So as you start letting things in and out, you've got exactly the same problem you have with a firewall, right? Firewall's letting things in and out. Your host is letting things in and out. You've got the same problem of sorting out the good stuff from the bad stuff. And if your premise is that your firewall can't do it, I can promise you your host can't do it either. So that's one problem. The second problem is that there are certain things in the network that are inherently trusted that are not trustworthy. When somebody talks to me about deperimeterization, I usually like to raise my hand and say, how are you going to handle ARP and DNS?
Mm-hmm.
And if they can't answer that question, or even worse, if they don't understand that I just pulled the rug out from under their feet, then, you know, I know I'm dealing with a security newbie who's just drunk some deperimeterization Kool-Aid. Because obviously, if you're saying you can't trust the network, well, what about ARP? Right? I can take over your traffic to your gateway router, and at that point, your systems trust so many things on the network. Now, sure, if we had a secure DNS and some kind of reliable port-based ARP and an actual functioning PKI so that all those digital certificates on websites and Microsoft and everything actually meant something, then we might be able to achieve some degree of host security, but that's kind of ridiculous.
Well, DNSSEC, I mean, everyone's been saying, DNSSEC is coming. It's like the second coming, for God's sakes. It's, you know, people keep saying, hey, any day now, but guess what?
Well, it hasn't been 2,000 years, but I was talking to a revivalist preacher the other day, and he said that that when Jesus comes again, he's going to roll out IPv6 and DNSSEC.
Nice.
So, I mean, that's really the problem, though, because unless you've got a trustworthy DNS, I don't care how strong your host is, because you're going to talk to something on your network,
well, look,
and I'll
feed
you whatever I want to.
Yeah, but I mean, even if your DNS is balked, like if your upstream DNS is bad, if you've got solid PKI, I mean, you know, and signed certs and a decent trust hierarchy, which I know we're talking about, you know, fantasy here, but if you do have all of that stuff, then all of a sudden it's not such a huge problem anymore that your DNS got hijacked.
Yes and no, right? Because again, right now when you look at what's going on with firewalls, the problems that organizations are having with firewalls, the problems that they're having is that some employee clicks on something or other, or goes to some site that they shouldn't or whatever, and the next thing you know, they got a piece of malware on their machine. And the piece of malware goes and tunnels out through the firewall and all their buddies come in, right? And, you know, how is that a whole lot different from I've got strong security and I go to the wrong place or I click on the wrong attachment and now I get a piece of malware on my machine and it modifies the executables on our shared file server?
Sure, but we were talking about something different there, which was about being connected to a different host and a host sort of pretending to be something else, which the PKI proposition takes care of quite cleanly. Of course, you're going to be left with the same problems of unauthorized execution. Unless we have operating systems that actually have in themselves, you know, some decent crypto stuff in them, which means you can only run code signed by certain authorities. I mean, do you think we're heading in that direction as well?
I think we're heading towards lockdown execution control. That's the only way of dealing with a lot of this. You know, you're throwing up all these things and saying, well, if we solved all these, then deperimeterization would work. And basically what you're saying is if we actually had secure systems, then we'd be okay. I'm violently in agreement with that.
So, I mean, really what you're saying is deperimeterization is what you wind up with in a perfect world, I think is what you're getting at here.
Exactly. And as long as you're in anything less than a perfect world, deperimeterization is not going to be any better than firewalls. I mean, I can build you a firewall that is, you know, pretty much guaranteed that you're never going to have a problem. That's because it's a pair of wire cutters. But, you know, in a perfect world, you can actually build networks that are firewalled that are insanely tough to get into. They're also insanely difficult to do stuff with. Right? And the premise that I'm operating under, and I can't really prove it logically, but the premise that I'm operating under is if your host security was so good that nothing could possibly go wrong, it would probably be just as annoying as an ultra-tight firewall.
Mm.
That's the problem. You know, the hackers, there's this problem in security with transitive trust, which is, of course, if I trust you and you trust somebody else, I trust that person even though I don't know them, which is a really bad thing, and most of us wouldn't do that with our money, but we do it all the time with our computers. The hackers are not currently using transitive trust attacks against us because they don't have to. Because the systems that we're dealing with are so weak and shabby that they basically can just exploit basic flaws and walk straight into them. But when I talk to people who say, oh, well, all we need to do is fix these basic flaws and we're going to be okay, I don't think so. If we fix these basic flaws, what's going to happen is that the hackers are going to evolve towards having to start exploiting really sophisticated attacks like transitive trust.
We have seen attacks that exploit transitive trust. And, you know, one of them we just were talking about on the show a couple of weeks ago, which is when, you know, these spammers are now sending out links to Google Docs, right? Because everyone trusts Google Docs. They want to let those URLs through the spam, you know, gateway or whatever. I mean, it's a really basic example, but it is what you're talking about. And before that, there was that other example of people who'd found a way to actually spam using Gmail's service, which, you know, was a real trust exploitation issue as well, because they could get around most spam firewalls.
Right, and you can see that the spammers are financially motivated in exploiting the cutting edge of ways to get into systems. And transitive trust is an ancient problem. I mean, the Association of Computer Security Graybeards were worrying about this back when the Orange Book was being written. And it's a very difficult problem to solve. And unfortunately, you know, all of the systems that we're working on and almost all the networks that we're working on simply just kind of sweep that whole problem under the rug. But it's going to come up. If we actually did have really good host security that we had no problems with, then you've got the problem that each host is isolated, and for that host to be able to do something valuable, it has to be able to do that valuable thing with some other system. And then you have this web of machines that are relying on each other, and that gives you the probability of transitive trust attacks.
Cheery!
I'm sorry.
Well, Marcus Renham, thank you again once more for your Yoda-like security insights and for taking some time out to speak to us here on Risky Business.
My pleasure.
That was our favourite cynic and regular sponsor guest, Marcus Rannan there from Tenable Network Security. And that wraps up this week's show. Taking us out is something a bit different this week. This is a track from a band I used to go and see in Melbourne when I was underage, sometime in the early 90s. And I will say no more, but I hope you enjoy it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. So what are you doing over there except besides being drunk under the table by the locals?
I've actually done very little drinking so far.
We know what happens when you try to outdrink the locals in strange lands.
Don't even start off on me, dude.
You just failed to represent.
Failed to represent? Almost got thrown out of my hotel. Actually, almost got thrown out of a hotel at SharkaCon too.
Sit it once, it'll see it twice. Sit it once, it'll see it one more time. you need to fall.